Accession number 8870, roll number 1.
Admiral Norman, real 1.
Did you come from a naval family?
No, not naval. We were an army family, really. Both my brothers were one a sapper and one a gunner. And I was the only one who went into the Navy.
How was it then that you came to join the Navy?
Well, really, because I'm a pessimist, I think, because I put my name down for everything the civil service exam qualified you for. It was quite interesting that I passed the same marks, passed me into the army, both sappers and to the Camberley, and into the Navy and Royal Marines, and into the civil service. But the position resulting was interesting. Anyway, I did get into the Navy, and I thought it was a change for the family, and I took that.
You had no personal ambition to join the Navy?
Not originally. I hoped to get into something.
You're sent to Keyham?
Yes. The public school entry was sent there, and actually when war broke out I was in Khaki in the officer cadet and in under canvas in camp, and when war broke out on the 4th I went straight home, changed out of my khaki into blue uniform, went up to London and then down to Plymouth, and that's how we joined.
What was the general reaction in the college to the outbreak of war?
Well, we were terribly keen, of course, to get into the war in case it stopped before we got into any form of action. I think everybody was rather inclined that way to begin with.
You're attached to HMS Queen Elizabeth, which at that time was the Royal Navy's latest super dreadnought.
Yes, the first batch of my term to go to sea, I was lucky enough to be in it. Went partly to the Queen Elizabeth, which was commissioning at Portsmouth, the first of her class, and half a dozen, I think, went off to one of the battleships which was actually in commission. But we commissioned on the 1st of January 1915 at Portsmouth, and that's where my first ship.
Did you feel yourself especially lucky to get?
Oh, terribly lucky, yes. We were thrilled, I think, to get away. And with a new ship with the latest form of director firing, 15-inch guns, it was a tremendous excitement.
As midshipman, what was your status on board the Queen Elizabeth?
Well, the proverbial status of a midshipman, as probably you know, is a means of abuse between two officers of unequal seniority. In actual fact, of course, we were old for our seniority. We were 17, I think, 16 to 18, roughly. And we found life, I thought, very interesting, and not at all what the original story was of midshipmen being kicked around. And when war broke out, we have fellows, thrown to responsibility straight away.
On some ships, undoubtedly midshipmen were sort of hazed a great deal. Do you think that it was the fact that you were older or the particular ship that you avoided this?
No, I think the times were changing very rapidly.
What was the midshipman's mess like? What conditions?
Very crowded. We were 30-odd in one room, and sometimes couldn't all sit down, of course, at once.
Did you have an allowance from home, any form
of pay? No, I don't think I did, or very small, if I can't remember it. We were all hard up in those days.
What was your pay?
I think it was one and something a day, 1 and 9 pence a day or something like that. And a 10 bob wine bill for the month, which wasn't really much.
Did you drink wine?
No, practically never. Gin was very cheap, and that's why I think we took to it.
There was no social distinction between the midshipmen?
No, very little, no.
The Queen Elizabeth sailed to Gibraltar to work out.
Yes. That was a very rapid show. We were only there, I think, for about 3 weeks. And we had the unfortunate accident of stripping a turbine. However, that didn't stop us. We went on to the Dardanelles on the one shaft not working, if I put it that way. And while we were there, we had a party of the Walls End Slipway Company sent out to do the repair. They were, of course, civilians and weren't frightfully appreciative of going into action. And they were commonly termed the Walls End Slipshod Company by the gunroom, I remember.
They were actually taking them to the Dardanelles?
Yes. We didn't. I think we landed them when we went in for the first big bombardment. That was on March the 18th. But on other days, we had them on board working, and they actually repaired the job by opening up the turbine and removing the stripped blades.
Did the orders to go to the Dardanelles come as a surprise to the crew, because you were only working up at that time? Or had you expected to be sent?
I think the fact that we went to Gib rather gave us the idea we were going there. I can't remember the exact feeling at the time, but certainly that was our big ambition, to get it out there.
What was your action station on board the Queen Elizabeth?
I was one of the turret midshipmen, actually the quarterdeck turret, and well, it's a terribly interesting job for a midshipman. The turret was manned by the Royal Marines, and I had a very interesting time. I was very fond of the gun layer of the right gun, a Bombardier Simons by name, who was subsequently proved to be a very accurate gun layer when we did some of the bombardments. But I'll tell you a story about that, I think, later on when we get on to the actions out there.
What precisely were your duties in the turret?
Well, the turret midshipman in bombardments was to set the fuses when we were firing shrapnel. Just before the last action, before the projectile was rammed home. Well, perhaps I better tell you the yarn now. One stood on the loading arm, leaning on the big projectile, which weighed a ton, I might say, and when the telephone message came through the setting, one set the fuse, called out fuse set, and jumped clear, and the projectile was rammed home. And on the particular occasion, I remember we were off the coast after the landing had taken place at a position which was, I think, subsequently called Gagan's Bluff. And I remember the name well because I married Miss Gagan, whose uncle was the soldier after whom the name Gagan's Bluff was called. But I didn't know that at the time. But what I did know was that this setting at that particular moment was the lowest setting we'd ever had called. And I was so interested, I leapt off the loading arm, ran round to Corporal Simons' position at the side of the gun, which was the one with the telescope. He was, at that time, of course, was laying the gun by director and was not in the position. I leapt into his sitting position and looked through the telescope, and I could see on the shore, only about 2,000 or 3,000 yards away, a line of Turks charging down on towards this bluff, Gagan's Bluff, where there was a party of our troops cut off. Anyway, at that moment, the gun fired, and I couldn't see anything because of the smoke. And when it cleared, I cast my eyes straight back to the telescope and couldn't see a moving soul. And the record of the war afterwards, though, is this is actually reported, that they could only see occasionally old Turk crawling away on all fours. We practically wiped out the whole battalion.
You're firing shrapnel?
Yes, there are 20,000 bullets in a 15-inch shrapnel, so it's a pretty solid mass.
When you were firing so close to the shore, the guns must have been firing horizontally.
Yeah.
Did you usually fire reduced charges?
Yes, yes, you're quite right. And actually, very, very low charges. I think we came down to quarter charges for shrapnel firing.
Generally, the naval bombardments held not to have been as effective as it was.
No, no. It was very sad because these big projectiles ploughed into the earth and really didn't do very much damage to the people there, and particularly as the Turks had very wisely hidden their guns and brought them out into a firing position and then retarded them back under cover, so we didn't do very much direct damage.
Did the lack of effect of the bombardment, did that lower morale on the ship?
Oh, no, the morale on the ship was high, and I think that the troops ashore were tremendously encouraged by having big stuff going over their heads, and because they could see the forts, which we knocked about, of course, we knocked out the heavy guns in the forts, but their chief concern were the field guns, which popped out and fired shrapnel at them and then retired behind them, and we couldn't touch them.
The big bombardment is on the 18th of March.
That was the big day when we, well, because our losses were fairly high that day.
Did you see any of the losses?
Yes, I did. I was actually on the bridge for some reason or other when the Bouvet, French cruiser, passed us, and she hadn't gone very far before she hit a mine. She was steaming along, and she literally put her nose down. She got a list from the blow and steamed straight underwater, and there wasn't a soul to be seen. I think they did pick up one or two, but roughly 700 or 800 men just plunged straight underwater.
What was your feeling at the time? Can you remember?
Well, it was a bit of a shock.
Later in the day, the British ships along.
Yes, yes, which, they ran onto mines, and we actually picked up three of the irresistible midshipmen. I can remember them. They were bright yellow from the fumes of the lyddite shells which they had been hit by. They gradually wore off. One remembers them very, very acutely because of being so bright yellow, I think, when we first saw them.
After the events of the day, some naval commentators said that the naval forces should have returned to continue the bombardment.
Yes. Well, I think that was largely Roger Keyes, who was chief of staff at the time, and as subsequently proved, a tremendous firebrand. He was always ready to fight. He was very keen, I think, to get the fleet to go back and to charge through to see if we could get through with the Turks probably licking their wounds and possibly short of ammunition in their big guns at the Narrows. But the chief danger was mines, and we'd not been able to sweep those. We hadn't got the proper sweepers. In fact, we only had the ex-trawlers out there, and they, of course, were right under the guns of the Turks the whole time.
Did the losses of the 18th of March, did the crew generally feel that, to justify them, the Navy ought to persevere?
Well, I think it was mixed. I must say, I was thinking perhaps a bit ahead, always wondered how we would be able to control a beaten country unless we had means far beyond what we had out there at the time. Whether the army were able to take over a country, I don't know. But that would come out later in my life. It was brought home to me because at the end of the war, I was serving in another ship, but in the fleet that went up to the Sea of Marmara. And what I better tell you now, the first night we was a massed fleet of Allies, and we paraded off Constantinople. And then as the evening drew on, the fleet retired into the Marmara for the night, leaving my little destroyer alongside as the connecting link with a party who were up in the embassy. And that was the link between the fleet and the shore party. And during the night, that first night alongside, an urgent message came through to be delivered to the embassy. And so I took a couple of sailors and tried to find my way through a conquered city without lights, without any organization. It seemed to be paralyzed, a few cats prowling around the place, but not a soul to speak to. There were no lights, and it was a very difficult job to find. However, after 2 or 3 hours struggling, we did find the place and delivered the message. And I thought to myself, well, if that had been an actual capture by the Allies, how would we have run that city? Who was there to know how to run the civil services, the water and all the things? And we had no preparation for it in 1915. In fact, little enough preparation for even doing the landing, let alone to take over a country.
What was the general opinion of the Turks, their resistance in Dartmoor?
Oh, they were very tough fighters. I don't know whether they were highly skilled, but they were certainly tough. Later on, again, that reminds me, I went back to Turkey in 1950. By that time, I was... Yes, I was an admiral, Rear Admiral, Chief of Staff to the Commander-in-Chief of Mediterranean. And we'd been sent up there to pay an official call. And at the first meeting, the Turkish Chief of Staff was a general who came on board. And through an interpreter, he asked me if I knew Turkey. And I said no, but I had been there once before in 1915 when I had knocked at the door and they'd slammed it in my face. After this was interpreted to the old Turk, he beat himself on the chest and said, ah, but I was there and I helped slam the door. From that moment on, he and I had a great time together.
There was a great deal of criticism later of the naval commanders, Carden and de Robeck. Did you see anything of either of the admirals?
Yes, we flew de Robeck's flag. Carden, I didn't know at all. He was a sick man, I think, and his health gave way, and de Robeck took over, and we all admired him and thought the world of him. I remember seeing him sitting on an armchair on top of the compass platform, actually on a little square top to the navigator's caboose, and sitting there with his thumbs in the armpits of his coat and surveying everything under his command, made a great impression on us all. He never took a cover in action.
Did you see anything of the landings of the 25th of April?
25th, yes. We had, of course, both commanders-in-chiefs on board, and cruised from one landing to another, and we picked up a boat, I remember, off Cape Helles in the afternoon, which was full of, well, not full, it was about half a dozen to a dozen wounded men. And they were drifting around. I think about two or three could use an oar. But the word was passed to the quarterdeck turret to try and get the boat alongside, and the ship manoeuvred over. Eventually, I was sent out from the turret with half a dozen marines to get the men out of the boat. And there was a tough guy sitting in the stern sheets, chewing the pipe stem, and he chewed it all away until the actual bowl of the pipe was rubbing against his cheek, but he kept it in his mouth and issued orders to everybody around, including me. And I said, come on, Tom, we've got to get you out of this boat. Let me help. And it's difficult enough to get you up the side of the ship anyway. And finally, his turn, the last, I thought, well, come on, get up. And he said, no, you've got to lift me. And when we lifted him, we found that one leg was completely shattered. There seemed to be very little of it left. But he'd never mentioned it before. And we got him on board and took him forward, so straight forward to the sick bay. When the action that day finished, I went straight forward to sick bay to inquire after my friend of the boat with the pipe had been operated on, and he was reported as doing quite well, that as soon as he'd come over out of his anesthesia, he demanded for his something-something pipe, who'd pinched it from him.
These were English troops?
Yes.
On the ships, was there any impression on that first day of how well or badly the action was going?
Yeah, they were held up practically at all beaches. And of course, they hadn't, in every case, made the beach which they intended to. Sometimes they'd landed. In certain cases, it worked very much to our advantage because they landed on rocky, narrow beaches, but they had the protection of the cliffs and therefore didn't suffer casualties. On the open beaches, I'm afraid some of the casualties were appalling. In fact, they didn't get across the beaches at all.
Life on the battleships was quite different from the life of the troops on the shore.
Oh, yes. We went, turned in at night and had a stand easy. The other wretched fellows ashore were fight and watch on and stop on in those early days, and the difficulty was to get A, supplies to them, and B, reinforcements.
What were the worst problems of existence on the battleships at this time?
I don't know if they had particular problems.
Were conditions in those comfortable?
Yes. Until they weren't very comfortable for my gun room, of course, because when we were hit by a Turkish, I think it was an 8-inch shell, landed on top of the gun room, and we never had a mess from that moment on. We lived in the flat outside. It was not very pleasant.
Some sailors complained of the almost the boredom of the isolated existence within the battleships off the Dardanelles. Was there much intership visiting?
Not very much, no. It was you couldn't do anything. There was no landing anywhere. It was just ship routine. But I think most fellows were thinking, of course, their brothers and so forth ashore, every effort was made to try and alleviate position, and of course difficulties later developed in dealing with the wounded when trying to bring them off, and B, to put them in ships, because we filled up the hospital ships, as far as I remember, fairly quickly. And sometimes, I believe, I may be wrong over this, I believe we actually took some of the wounded we had brought off, put them back again ashore, because we couldn't find any space for them. But that's only once I can remember that happening.
As a midshipman, did you do picket boat duty?
I personally didn't do it at the action, but I did do a picket boat duty. At one period, later on, actually, the only time I ever took command of Dickie Mountbatten, because he joined the ship at Scarpa Flow when David Beatty flew his flag and relieved Jericho. Four midshipmen came from the Lion, one of them Mountbatten. And I was running one of the bigger boats, and I had as a second Dickie Dickie Mountbatten, and then he was considered fit to take over. The only time I ever senior to Mountbatten.
But during your time off the Dardanelles, you're more or less confined to the ship.
Yes, I never had a boat there.
The Queen Elizabeth, I think, was fortunate in that she used often to return to Mudros rather than be left at her anchorage.
Oh, well, we all retired in those early days, and it was only for a limited time until the threat of submarine arriving out there that we stopped anchoring off the beaches. We all went back to Mudros. Tenedos to begin with, and then Mudros.
Battleships were often regarded as the school of young midshipmen. Did the normal training of midshipmen for their lieutenancies, did that continue throughout the...
Yes, as far as we could, yes. We had to do all our lessons and so forth in various subjects. But, of course, when action came along, that went worse. I do remember working all one night when we had some photographs brought of the beaches taken... to show, as far as we could, what defences the Turks had got, and that was before the, only a day or two before the landing, and I must say it was a very primitive way of giving information, because I don't know whether I could have ever found my way around with what we produced for them, but that's all we could give them.
Bombardment was generally confined by the lack of proper observation.
Well, it was always restricted, yes. We did fairly well with the balloon. There was a ship came out there called the Manicot, I think it was, which had a kite balloon thing. And with that spotting, we were quite effective. It always impresses one to think one fired over Europe into Asia. It wasn't really very much. The difficulty was to get the shells to come down into the narrows where the ships, the Goeben and others, came. But at any rate, I can do remember that the fire over the peninsula was threatening enough to make the Turks withdraw as soon as we started bombarding over the peninsula.